You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a YA children's literature theme to today's show. Our studio guest is Imbali Aselis, author of the Foxcraft series. We'll also be hearing from Julian Sedgwick on completing his Ghosts of Shanghai trilogy. And Rosemary Hayes will be talking to us. She's written more than 30 books for children. So, hello, Imbali. Nice to have you with us.
Hello.
We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But this market, the children's market, the YA market, which I know you don't write for, but that whole market just seems very buzzy and diverse at the moment.
It is. I think it's been a time of great and rapid change. It's quite bewildering for a lot of writers, but also a lot of opportunities coming up. So a few years ago, there was a lot said about middle grade being totally dead and everything was about YA. And that was the time of Twilight and the paranormal romance. And I think the pendulum has probably swung in the opposite direction. So now fantasy middle grade has had its second wind. Thank goodness for me, but not for all. And YA is a pressed market. So I hear.
So by middle grade, you're meaning what kind of age?
We've adopted the American nomenclature. I'm talking about 8 to 12, 9 to 12, sort of the key Harry Potter classic children's book market, that kind of age range, so chapter books.
A great time to be a young reader, though, isn't it? So much choice.
I think so. I think it's remarkable. I mean, that the options available are so broad. There was a time, I think, where if you didn't like Enid Blyton, tough, really. But now that are really books for all children and across all levels of complexity as well.
And it's encouraging that children are still reading, because we think of children maybe being glued to the screen, but obviously they're still picking up a book and getting something from the page.
I certainly hope so. I mean, you see different stats about readers and possibly boy readers not reading as much. I think the great thing about the age range I write for is there's still massive enthusiasm for books and stories. I imagine the drop-off comes a little bit later, and I don't know how it would be to go into schools and talk to 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and I imagine some of their interests are shifting. But certainly for the age range I write for, and I don't write books which are branded as girl books or boy books or whatever, so I have the fun of being able to talk to kids who are genuinely excited about stories.
And you do have a lot of interaction with your readers, don't you?
I do. I mean, it's World Book Day, or we call it World Booked Week. It has been running very recently, and I've been quite recently to a local school, and amazing enthusiasm from the school. That was with Heffer's. And I do go into schools whenever I can, not as much as I'd like to, just because I'm so pressed for time, but when I can, I do. And I also interact with readers on social media, and if they contact via my website, though I'm running very much at a delay. So if you've contacted me via the website, I'm sorry, I will definitely answer.
Just there you are, you've got it now. You're committed now to doing that. Well, as I say, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're going to play your first choice of music now, which is Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush. Why this one?
This one because, so I always have playlists for each story, and this was the key song of the playlist for Foxcraft 1, The Taken, where Isla's being chased. I'll tell you more about that soon.
That's Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Imbali Aserlis. Imbali is one of the team of authors behind the New York Times best-selling Survivor series, writing under the pseudonym Erin Hunter. Her first book, The Tigreen Cat on the Run, won the Calderdale Children's Book of the Year Award, and The Independent included it in the list of 50 books every child must read. The Taken, the first book in her Foxcroft trilogy, was published in 2015. The Elders was released a year later, and the final book, The Mage, came out last year. So Imbali, the obvious question really, why this genre? Why? How did you end up writing for this age group?
So I do hear a lot of writers saying that all they've ever dreamt of is writing a book, and that was not me because, well, for lots of reasons, it just doesn't seem open to me. I'm a bit dyslexic and I wasn't very good at school. I can't spell. I still can't spell. And that seemed to be a bit of a barrier back then. I was really into drawing and I illustrated a lot and I doodled over everything. But my kind of work trajectory took me in different directions. And I wasn't at all thinking about writing a story, though I had written maniacally and strange stories, futuristic dystopia, that sort of thing, when I was at uni, but I never shared those stories with anyone. And I always wrote poetry as well. So what changed? Well, I was actually training to be a lawyer at the time, and I was visiting my parents who live in Cambridge. I wasn't living in Cambridge then, I was in London. And they had friends visiting, including a little boy who didn't speak English, and he was getting upset. And when I was little, my great dream was to have a cat. My parents weren't really into this, so I pestered them relentlessly. And after getting through numerous other pets like gerbils and goldfish and hamsters and rabbits and guinea pig and so on, I finally graduated to a kitten who was the love of my life. So I fancied I knew a thing or two about cats, and I was leafing through an encyclopedia of cats, because I do believe that it is impossible to feel depressed while looking at pictures of cats. And there was a picture of the Mao, and it said, these are the cats that most resemble the cats of ancient Egypt, the first domestic cats. And let me describe this cat: long pointed face, kind of yellowish eyes, pointed ears, a little bit creepy, a little bit scary, little bit evil, maybe even, and a word I don't use lightly, or perhaps a little bit too lightly in this instance. But in any event, I started to think, that's not right. There's the Abyssinian cats, and they're the cats that people often say are like the first domestic cats. And I started to think about what if there was an ancient rivalry between two tribes of wild cats that stalked the deserts of the world? What if all domestic cats came from those cats? And what if even those who believe the legends considered that all of those wild cats became extinct on domestication many thousands of years ago? And what if they're wrong? And that's how the Tigreen cat came about. The Tigreen cat was the very last cat of the Abyssinia Tigreen, and the Sar Mau are intent on wiping that tribe out. And that is how the first story began. So it wasn't at all intended. It's always, for me, the story. It's just the story pops into my head and then I follow it. And I try to cut down on anything that feels like interference. It's just following the story. I never think, what is the market doing? Is this going to work? Should I put in a male character so that it appeals to boys? Or should I do... I never do any of that stuff. I'm like fully intuitive. It's just whatever feels right.
So how did you end up with foxes? Why foxes?
So I was living in central London at the time, and the amazing thing is, and I haven't seen this in Cambridge, but I have in the Fens, that you see foxes all the time when you live in London. We had a communal garden and I saw foxes lived there. And when I got a puppy, I started to see them a lot more frequently, and I would walk around the streets where I lived around twilight, which is fox magic hour really, and I'd see the foxes. And they... what can be more extraordinary than seeing a wild animal in the streets of London? I don't know about you, but I can't fail to get a shiver when I see them. They're so beautiful and so mysterious. And what do they really get up to, and what are they like? And the more I read about foxes, first of all, there's 10 wolf books to every one fox book. The truth is, we just don't know that much about them. We don't understand all their vocalizations. We don't fully understand how they live. There was a major research project in Bristol and Oxford about foxes, but mostly they are under research, and yet they are one of the most ubiquitous species, the red fox. They have and essentially annexed every territory of the world. They haven't got to Antarctica, and pretty much that's it. They're everywhere else. So they are survivors. And then the more I read about them in literature, children's literature and folklore, they start off a few thousand years ago being the tricksters, the itinerant kind of salesmen of the story world. And then around medieval Europe, they become aligned with the devil. They are evil, they are wicked. That's from the stories of Reynard the Fox, in French, in Flemish, in Latin, and translated ultimately into English. And that seems to persist. So the fox is always the bad guy in children's books. And I thought it was sort of time to right the wrong, and I felt the fox's voice rising, and I wanted to tell another story.
Well, yes, the fox's voice rising, because you do tell it from the point of view of the foxes, which means putting yourself in the paws, I suppose,
yes,
of a fox, seeing the world from their point of view.
That's right. So it is not traditional in fantasy, and particularly in children's fantasy, to tell fantasy from a first-person viewpoint. And it is, as far as I'm aware, hasn't been done at all in animal fantasy. I'm not familiar with any animal fantasy that's first person anyway. And I thought seriously about this. The difficulty, of course, is with fantasy, you have a massive landscape. So if you commit to one character first person, obviously with Game of Thrones, adult fantasy, but still same rules apply. If you move character, you can have a larger landscape, which he does. But if you have just one character's viewpoint, you're really limiting yourself. How do you create this massive world if the character herself doesn't understand the world? How are you going to teach her without being overly didactic in the way you're teaching the story, like you don't want to have too much exposition or whatever? So I created a lot of challenges for myself, but at the same time, I really wanted to bring myself and the reader right into the mind of a fox, to see the world, to smell the grass, to sense the snow on your whiskers. All of this was really important to me.
But that's a lot of world building, isn't
yes.
it? I mean, that's there's a whole language and the way they perceive
yes.
things and labels. It really is sort of it's almost like acting, isn't it? Imagining how it must look to an animal.
And sometimes I did just act it out. I would actually just get on my, on all fours and have to feed. I do that. I wonder how many other writers do this. I suspect quite a lot of us do. You actually act out little sequences to work out how it would work and who would be where. It was key to get into the story. And while I didn't create an entire vocabulary for foxes, because that would make it too difficult to read and follow, if there were words that felt very, very human, like car, it just doesn't feel foxy at all, and they're human inventions, then I would need to think about what to call them. I say car because car was the hardest one. Some of them felt quite natural. So the road is the death way. It's essentially one big road, because from a fox's viewpoint, it's not lots of roads. It's just this horrible kind of river of death that they, and sadly more foxes die on the roads than any other way, urban foxes certainly. But for cars, I thought long and hard and eventually reached manglers.
Manglers, good. And humans as well. I like humans.
Yeah, the furless. What is the single defining quality of if you are a bushy red furred creature to see these strange naked creatures pottering about?
And though it's a different world, I mean, it's similarities with our own, isn't it? There's pollution, there are tribes, territory, conflict,
yes.
politics. Definitely. You're aware of that it's sort of mirroring the human world.
Absolutely. And indeed the politics. So, and this gets even more the case in the third book, which is the Mage, because in that book, Isla and the fox travels up to the frozen lands, the snow lands, and that's where the snow wolves live. And because wolves, fundamentally because they're hunting large quarry, they're hunting creatures that are much larger than they are, they have to work as a team. And so they live in these large, in the story they're called bishars, they're kingdoms, we call them packs, but the truth is they're massive extended family units. They're big families, that's how they, and they're highly hierarchical because they need to understand where they fit in order to work effectively like any kind of military unit would. So for that I draw on various kind of warish cultures, such as human cultures like Vikings and Maori, to draw on kind of the identity of the wolves. The foxes, in a way, were the greatest challenge of all, because in the legend, the folklore of the story, the wolves ran off from the humans, back in the early days, but they built up that they're kind of subject to their own laws and their own controls, and therefore they are still slaves of a kind because they still howl to their ancestors and they still follow these rules. The dogs are the slaves to the furless. Life just became too comfortable with the furless and they forgot their independence. Whereas the foxes, in their own legends, consider themselves to be the only free canids, the only free sons and daughters of Canister. And so in a way, they don't quite fit any human kind of identifiers because they are different. They are not highly hierarchical. They do share their food, but they don't hunt together. So they're a cross between cats and dogs. You can't quite place them. And indeed, they hunt a lot like cats. They don't like aggressive hunting. In fact, they're far less aggressive than cats, but they don't like conflict. So that's why they love chickens, because we've essentially manufactured a creature so witless and so innocent and unable to protect itself that it's the fox's ideal prey, because foxes don't really like things that bite or scratch, which is why most of the stories about foxes killing cats are just nonsense, because foxes are scared of cats. They don't like scratchy creatures.
And we're going to hear from Julian Sedgwick in just a moment about writing a trilogy. This is a trilogy. Was it always intended to be a trilogy?
Yes, it was. And that was something I was very clear on. I really wanted it to be sold as a trilogy because I didn't want to reach a point where I darked it in a certain way and then I couldn't write it that way. So it was really important. In essence, it's one story told in over three major territories. So the Taken takes place in the sprawling Greylands, the city. And then at that point, the quest continues into the wildlands, the forest and the fjords in the Elders. And in the third book, The Mage, it takes place largely in the snowlands. So it's separated by kind of distinct locations and sub-quests and challenges. But in essence, it's one overarching story.
Right, thank you. Well, we'll come back to you in Bali, but from one trilogy to another, as I say, Julian Sedgwick's first book, Mysterium, The Black Dragon, was published in 2013 and won the Rotherham Children's Book Award. His graphic novel, Dark Satanic Mills, written in collaboration with his brother Marcus, was shortlisted for the Kate Greenaway Medal. The first book in his Ghosts of Shanghai trilogy came out in 2015, and the final one, Return to the City of Ghosts, was published in January. I went to the launch at Heffer's Bookshop, and it was there I asked Julian how he felt about having finally completed the trilogy.
It feels particularly rewarding to finish this trilogy because I started writing it 10 years ago and it was very hard to get publishers on board. They thought it might be too difficult being historical. And to have finally got the last book out feels like a great chance to celebrate.
And are there particular challenges associated with writing a trilogy? Not just the amount of words, but actual plots and keeping characterisation consistent?
Yeah, it's a real challenge because obviously if you want to have a kind of thriller trilogy, you're going to have plot strands that get resolved in each book and then some things that are going arching over all three. So I make very extensive charts and plot charts and try and make sure I don't miss anything I'm meant to do. And even then, you'll find you lose a little bit of focus sometimes on something that was happening. Because you might have been writing the first book 2.5 years ago, and you might have forgot a tiny detail that you meant to tie in at the end. So I do try and reread them as I go, but sometimes it's a matter of winging it, I think.
And did it work out how you thought it would work out, all the plots?
Yeah, I think it did, actually. Some of the key ideas that I had 10 years ago stayed in place right through. So I knew it was going to start in this ruined, haunted temple in the middle of Shanghai in 1926, and I knew the last scene would be in the same place. And I'd always wanted to have this big river journey in the middle of the trilogy. That stayed in place. So lots of things were exactly as I imagined they would be in the broad sense. But the huge change was the central character turned out to be a girl, not a boy, after all. So for a long time I'd been trying to get the book up and running and I couldn't make it work and I didn't know what was wrong. And one day I woke up and I thought, central character needs to be a girl. So I've got to change his name and his gender. So I reassigned his gender and suddenly it worked. And I've spent a long time thinking why that might have been the case, and I think it was because in the 1920s, even more so than now, to be a woman and to want to do something interesting with your life. So Ruby wants to be a journalist or a pilot. She wants to do something quite intrepid. So it was a bigger challenge. So that made the story work harder, possibly. So that was the main thing that changed. And then all the little things, you don't know what they're going to be. So all the tiny plot details, you find them as you write.
And Ruby, you mentioned there, presumably now after three books, you know her inside out. And Shanghai, I would have thought, inside out.
It's really strange because, with Ruby, I always doubted that thing that writers said that your characters will start telling you their story, but it really has happened with both the trilogies I've written. And Ruby is kind of an amalgam of three or four people I know initially, and I took little bits from each of them. And then she started to become her own person. And I'm very fond of her indeed. And she's often, when you're writing books initially, you write thinly disguised versions of yourself. But Ruby is definitely her own person. And Shanghai, I've researched it for two films and a TV series and this trilogy across 25 years. So I know historic Shanghai incredibly well. I've even got out huge street plans from the university library from the 19-teens and looked at these things. And I have still never been to the physical city.
You've never been?
No. Oh. It's ridiculous. And I was meant to go next month to a festival and it just fell through. So every time I've been on the verge of going, something has prevented me. But I am now penciled in to visit in March 2019. So.
Excellent. What is it about Shanghai that interests you?
At first, it was the fact that back then it was this extraordinary mix of glamour and danger. It always reminds me of the opening scene, the scene in Star Wars with the cantina scene where all the aliens are chatting. You know, there were like 50 different nations all crammed together. There were gangsters. There was a lot of still medieval superstition on the streets, so you could mess around with ghost stories. But also, it's really resonant for our times. It was troubled economically, politically, a huge gap between rich and poor. There were populists stoking up problems on all sides. There were new technologies delivering fake news. And, you know, into this, I thought, well, this is an incredible place to bring a child who has a slightly overactive imagination and has just suffered some terrible calamity, and what will happen to her.
So you've got three books. Do they feel different? I mean, are we right in thinking that in a trilogy you've got, it's like three acts of a play?
Yeah, I try and do that. And in fact, in each book, I tend to do a very rough three-act structure in my head. But I've always been particularly concerned that the middle book in each of the trilogies I've done is strong enough, because there's nothing more disappointing than reading a trilogy and the middle book being a bit flabby and not holding the weight of the story. So I've often tried to put some of the best stuff into the middle one to really give that a strong shape. And then often the last one's quite easy, because if you put everything in place across the first two books, the last one you just sort of follow the threads to their conclusion.
So can you read any of these books without reading the others, or do you need to read?
I think you'd have to read them in order. The publisher did try and encourage me to put in enough exposition subtly so someone could pick up the second or third one, but I really think I'd be interested, actually. Some people yesterday were buying book three confidently, so I'll find out from them perhaps. So, but they are designed to be read in order.
And as you say, you're following things that you, in book two and book three, that you set up in book one.
Yeah.
Do you ever wish you could go back and change something?
Yes. Sometimes you realise you've written yourself into a slight plot corner, but the first book's already published and printed, and there is no chance to go back and change it. So that's why I do quite a lot of planning before I start, just to try and avoid those problems. But then if you've got to think laterally and come up with a creative solution to a problem you've made, sometimes that has a nice texture to it and nice strength.
And what next for you? A standalone novel or another trilogy?
I'm going to leave trilogies just because they have been some of the most mind-curdling things I've done, even including my degree, I think. So I am going to do standalone, and I'm going to do a contemporary book set in Japan just after the tsunami. So I'm going month after next to Japan to go and do some research around Fukushima, around the nuclear power plants, and where people were still can't live, and just looking at the effects of this extraordinary event on, you know, impressionable young minds.
And what about trilogies for you? Do you have a favourite trilogy that you read, that you go back to?
I suppose growing up, when I was about 13, 14, 15, it was Lord of the Rings. There wasn't as much children's writing around, and it's still the great trilogy to look to. I think it has a structure that works really well. Most of the first things I used to write were pale imitations of Middle Earth, I think. I've enjoyed this challenge, but I think I want to try and do standalones for a little bit now and just feel what that's like.
And The Ghosts of Shanghai Trilogy by Julian Sedgwick is published by Hodder Children's Book. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Imbali Asirlis. Imbali, were you identifying with some of the things Julian was saying there about writing a trilogy? Particularly, I'm wondering about that middle book, you know, the tricky second book, as it were.
Well, I think the middle book of any trilogy is definitely challenging. I was thinking about that a lot, and it was challenging for me personally to write The Elders, because I had a baby in the middle.
Right.
He actually came, I had it all plotted out. I was just going to write and I'd get a draft down. But then he came a few weeks early, so I didn't get a draft down. And we were also moving to Cambridge and it was bonkers. The whole thing was bonkers. So I actually wrote it under possibly suboptimal conditions. I was back to writing about when he was about 12 weeks old. Though I did the end papers, which unfortunately you don't get in the UK editions because they come straight to paperback. But for the US editions, I did those when he was 4 weeks old between breastfeeding, like handed him over, quickly draw a bit, then pass him back. I did get that. So the second book was where I got most lost. And it's ironic really as well, because Isla is lost in the woods and the fjords and I got lost with her. And there's one bit where it was far too long and it was too complex and it wasn't quite working. And in the end, I sent it to my editor and said, I'm thinking I might do this with it and cut out this bit. And he said, I think that's exactly what you should do. And I went back to it and it just fell into place. And the funny thing is, although I would like to think that people get excited about the series overall, it's the second book that I get the most fan mail on. And it seems to be just on, of course, we never look at Amazon or anything like that. But on the review sites, the US review sites, it's the one that just seems to not have, there's no kind of negativity about it. Inevitably, there is somewhere along the line about something. But that book seems to have come up the most popular, which is ironic.
Well, that's encouraging, isn't it? That your instincts were right, even with the baby, the so-called baby brain.
Yeah, well, often you know when something's wrong, but you don't know how to fix it. But I actually think the key with writing isn't knowing how to fix it, because that comes, it's knowing what is wrong. So I'll look at the manuscript and I understand it's not working, but I can't understand which bit isn't working. And that's where editors are worth their weight in gold, because they can drill down straight to the point. And sometimes they'll have a great suggestion for you, or sometimes they just leave you with, I don't really think this character's working because of A, B and C or whatever. If it's structural, it's a headache. With The Elders, it was structural, and those are the hardest sort of rewrites. But sometimes it's got to be done.
It's got to be done. Well, time for your second choice of music now, which is Into the West by Annie Lennox. Why this one?
Well, this one is sort of the poignant, yearning song. So what I haven't said is that Foxcroft is fundamentally a search for family, because Isla's family go missing at the beginning, Isla being an urban fox cub, and she has to track them down. And in every quest, there are moments where you are lost and you don't know where to turn. In every trilogy, it's like that too. So that's why it spoke to me.
Night is falling. You've come to journey's end. Sleep now. Dream of the ones who came before. They are calling from across a distant shore. Why do you weep? What are these tears upon your face? Soon you will see all of your fears will pass away, safe in my.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is author of the Foxcraft Trilogy in Ballet Asalis. We were hearing Julian Sedgwick earlier on. Now, Julian writes for a slightly older age group than yourself in ballet,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes, a little bit older, I think.
But I was wondering how you draw a line for your readers as well, because in your books, I mean, Isla loses her family, mm-hmm. the mice are killed, nasty things happen to foxes. Children can get, you know, animals in jeopardy,
yes.
can be a bit of a trigger for children, isn't it? How do you decide where to stop?
It is difficult, and you want to be true to the reality of the really tough and frankly quite brutal world of the fox out in the wild, and also set against the kind of the day-to-day fears and terrors of losing family and so on. There is this very large sort of rising evil, the mage himself being this mysterious, we think, fox out in the wildlands, or in fact in the darklands, and what's he up to? So there is a lot of jeopardy in the story. I try to contain anything that it looks like direct violence. So there is a balance, and I don't kind of have gougings and ears being ripped off. And in fact, that was the only place where my editor made me pull back. There is one scene in the Snowlands where the brutal wolves, there's a fight between two wolves. One of the wolves severs the ear of another wolf and throws it down on the ground in front of him. And I possibly wrote that a little bit too viscerally. My editor said, that's a little bit gross. Pull it back. But generally, it's amazing how, I mean, so as you mentioned at the start of the interview, I've written under the pen name Erin Hunter, which is a group of writers who write. There's very popular series in America. And they, you know, the animals die frequently in those. So I think the reality is the reader's tolerance is surprisingly high, and it's how it's managed. There is genuine sadness and loss, and I think that's okay, because the reality is this happens in the real world. The children do lose their families, and they don't always, you know, parents die and they don't see them again. And there is real loss, and part of a book is catharsis. It's identification with the different sorts of emotion, including the sad ones, including the frightening ones, because ultimately the book will wrap you up and carry you through the frightening ones in safety. And I think the reader understands that. In fact, the only emotion I never try to inspire, and I'm very aware of that because these are children's books, is despair. I never leave a reader with despair. And there is a scene, so Isla's on this long quest to find her family, and there's a scene in the Snowlands where a blizzard is rising, and she is with one other fox who can no longer help her because it looks like he's dying, and there's no one to help her, and all the wolves are far away, and she's absolutely isolated and she can't get back. And in the deep snow, in the blizzard, she despairs. And it's the only moment in the story where she, this extremely resilient little fox, just sits down and thinks, that's it, I'm going to freeze here. I can't do it anymore. And then something happens to bring her back. And so even that moment of despair, I think, felt right after she's tried so hard and got so far. And we all feel that sometimes. We just can't do this anymore. And then somehow we draw on some deep, deep inner magic, this resilience, and we get up and we carry on and we make it. And so that was important, but I would never leave despair as the end of the story.
You, even though it's younger readers, you are still making larger points about things in there about animal cruelty, about pollution, about encroachment into green spaces.
Yes.
That's still comfortable within those parameters.
Yes, it's very much reflecting back on the real world, I think. The challenges and the feelings that the animals experience, the way in which they're pushed out and then blamed for being in a city which was once a land that they roamed freely anyway, and just possibly asking the reader to question a lot of the perceptions that are handed down. And there are certainly plenty of them about foxes, for instance. in everything I read about foxes, the sort of the common position is foxes are loners, they're itinerant, they just wander around, and this just simply isn't true. They have territory, they have family, they're very loyal to their family, they pair bond usually for life. And I think they're just entirely misrepresented. And even the most sensitive point of all, the surplus killing, the way that they get into the hen coop and so on, what they do in the wild is this instinct allows them to cache their prey. So they will bury it and they'll come back to it and their family will survive on that. What the wild doesn't equip them for is to have some 20 chickens in one go. So the instinct to kill and cache it doesn't work in a situation where we as humans have created a kind of a false situation. And what's more is they don't have the opportunity to come back and cache their prey, because usually the chickens are, you know, the foxes are chased away and so on.
Have you had any bad reactions to having foxes as the heroes of the book?
Not from readers. And I find that generally children have very open minds, and that's why inviting them to empathise with an animal is such a positive thing, I hope, I feel. But certainly, the number of debates and arguments I've had with adults is like, foxes, I hate foxes. I'm in endless discussions about foxes, and I say, bring it on. Because for every piece of false media and false information made about them, I can return with the actual facts, which are showing that foxes are really very sensitive, gentle animals. They don't have rabies, at least in this country, and they've done far less to harm the world around them. And they also are great pest controllers in the city, where they catch rats. And perhaps if we didn't leave so much rubbish around, they wouldn't so much want to come there. So I have quite... I'm happy to debate the point.
You won't hear any complaints from me. Well, let's stay with children's literature, but hear from Rosemary Hayes now. Rosemary has a background in publishing, first with Cambridge University Press and then running her own company, Anglia Young Books. Her first novel, Race Against Time, was runner-up for the Kathleen Fidler Award, and since then many of her books have won or been shortlisted for others. With more than 40 books to her name over 30 years, I put it to her when I met her that she'd written rather a lot.
Yes, I suppose I have. The first book I wrote was an idea that I had when my oldest son was little, and I started writing it then, and it was lucky enough to be runner-up in a major competition, and that was what really started me off, because after that, you know, publishers did start to ask me to write books for them. Those were in the days when it was much easier to get published.
Well, yes, over 30 years, you must have seen some changes perhaps in what your readers want, as well as the publishing world.
I've always written very selfishly for myself. I haven't actually taken a great deal of notice of the market. How it works, as far as I'm concerned, is I see something, an incident, and I put it away in my brain and I think, one day I must write about that. Or, as happened when I wrote the books about young Muslims in the UK, it was an article I saw in a newspaper about young moderate Muslims wanting their voices heard. And that struck me as really quite interesting. And although I'm not a Muslim, and I had to be very careful and research the subject very carefully indeed, I did want those voices to be heard. And that was how the first of those two books, Mixing It and Payback, came about. So as far as I'm concerned, it's something I have to feel very strongly about it. Occasionally I've been commissioned to write a particular series for a particular publisher, and that's a bit different. But the novels, it's always been something that has appealed to me, because as a writer I find it difficult to get enthused about something that I'm not enthused about.
Yes, well, looking at your books, there do seem to be some outstanding themes that emerge. You mentioned the Muslim book there. There often seems to be this theme of different cultures trying to understand each other. You've written a lot about Australia, people finding out about the past to understand the present. I mean, for you, are there certain themes that you like to come back to?
I wish I could be specific about that. I've always been interested in history, and sometimes an event, an historical event, will just grab me. I used to live in Australia, and that's why the sort of Australian connection is there. The Blue-Eyed Aborigine, the first shipwreck book that I wrote, it was because I visited the Shipwreck Museum in Western Australia in Fremantle, and I saw reference to this extraordinary event in Australian history that I'd heard nothing about. To be fair, I don't think many people in the eastern states of Australia are very interested, but it was a massacre and a mutiny and the most extraordinary voyage back to the East Indies, and then retribution, and eventually the mutineers were mostly hanged. But these two young men, their punishment was to be marooned on the coast of Western Australia, which of course, as far as 17th century seafarers were concerned, was empty. And they were told to try and find natives to trade with and given a few supplies, never heard of again. But later explorers to that region after settlement reported Aboriginals from the coastal areas with blue eyes and fair hair. So it's almost certain that these two young men may have survived and integrated, and then a further shipwreck about 80 years later. We know that there were survivors. That intrigued me, and I thought those two young men who were marooned in 1629, that was 150 years before Cook sailed into the other side of Australia. So they would have been the very first European settlers a long time before Cook, and yet so little is known about this story. That was what intrigued me, and after that I wrote about another shipwreck called the Zuytdorp, which, again, many more people survived that. We know that from reports of coastal tribes that talked about these for generations and passed down the stories about them. It just hit me as an amazingly interesting bit of Australian history.
So when you find something like that, do you think, I'm going to use this as the basis of a book for 7 to 10 year olds or for an older age group, or do you just write and see how it comes out?
A bit of both. The blue-eyed Aborigine, the story itself was very violent. And if you're writing about something that actually happened, you have to be true to the facts. And there were rapes involved and there was a lot of murder. So it really wouldn't have been suitable for young children. I very much pitched it really at top primary and lower secondary age group.
And you mentioned series of books there. I suppose there are advantages to writing series in that you get to know your characters very well, as do your readers. And each time you start a book, you don't have to establish so much about them.
The series I've written for very young children for Cambridge University Press, I wrote in their Cambridge Reading series, but they weren't linked, in fact, but I was commissioned to write 9 books, which is always very nice. But the other series I've written is, again, I was actually commissioned to do this, was to write about modern-day gypsies, to foster a bit more understanding between them and their culture and non-gypsies, because, as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of bullying and so on goes on in schools. And I had an absolutely fascinating time going around a lot of gypsy encampments in and around Cambridge with the head of gypsy education, of Romani education. And because of that entree, I was able to talk very freely to a lot of families. And it was a fascinating exercise, and I was able to write the books that I'm commissioned to write, which was from the point of view of the gypsy children and from the point of view of non-gypsy children, and how they came together in a rather unexpected way. This was for less able readers, so it was a specific age group that I was writing for, so that it was simple but was a cracking story.
And I know that you actually had experience of organising a children's writing competition when you worked at Cambridge University Press, or when you were working for them. I wonder if seeing what children were writing, seeing what appealed to them, I suppose, whether that stayed with you and influenced what you wrote.
Yes, they were very different. We had thousands of entries, and we had a shortlist, and then we had a final judging panel of some sort of luminaries like Michael Rosen and various others. And we produced an anthology of the winning stories. And the quality of the winning stories was exceptional. Yes, one particular story stood out for me. It was a child who'd had a very violent home life and had spent a lot of time in a women's refuge with his mum. And I often wonder what happened to that boy. He wrote absolutely beautifully, but his head teacher, who I met, said, once he gets to secondary school, I think he's going to just slip through the net. that story, I can still remember it very, very vividly.
Oh, if only we knew. And what about books for you, Rosemary? Has there been one book for you that influenced you when you were a child that you still think of now as an adult?
I think, like lots of people of my generation, C.S. Lewis and the Narnia books. I read all of those. And I still like writing fantasy. My books are very eclectic. As I say, I write about what interests me. I'm working at the moment on a fantasy. I've gone right back to where I started from, actually, which was a fantasy. That C.S. Lewis, with a very strong sort of moral theme, I don't suppose when I read them I was conscious of that, but I find that I really related to the children at that stage. Now I reread them, and they're so unlike modern children. It's quite interesting to know how I, as a child, related to them. But certainly they, and Elizabeth Googe, the sort of historical fiction that she wrote, I loved. So I suppose those were the two main influences on me as a child.
And Rosemary Hay's books have been published by a variety of publishers, but The Blue-Eyed Aborigine, which was the one she spoke about in the interview, was published by Francis Lincoln Children's Books. And you can find out more about Rosemary's work at her website, rosemaryhayes.co.uk. Well, we're coming to the end of our time with you in Ballyasellis on Bookmark, I'm afraid. But I'll ask you the same question that I put to Rosemary, which was about books that influenced her or stayed with her that she'd read as a child. Was the one that stayed with you?
I had, at different ages, different books that I'd become totally obsessed with. I was a very slow reader, and it took me a long time to get into a book, but then it would really, really stay with me. So the youngest ones I remember are probably the Moomin Adventures, which are still in print and multi-translated.
Yeah, they're beautiful illustrations. Yeah.
Beautifully illustrated and very otherworldly. They've got the sense of the magic of the world itself, so the magic that comes from the valley and the woods, which is my kind of magic. So the kind of this essence that rises from the very land. As I got older, they would tend to be, well, very often animal stories. And when, as an early teen, I really loved Great Expectations. That seems to be a book that one should read at 13 or 14. It just is that kind of book. And that was the book I carried around with me, not Holden Caulfield or something like that. But though I also really loved The Bell Jar, it really depressed me. Whereas Great Expectations, despite all the miseries Pip has to endure, there is hope in there. And so that would probably be the one that lingered.
So from books that you read then to books you're reading now, this is a question we ask all our guests. What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've just had a lull between books. I read Exit West recently. And at the moment, I am ploughing through the poetry books I leave by my bedside, which is sort of what I do between books. I love poetry, and the ones I've got there, so I have quite a large collection, and then I always keep a few by the bed, and the ones I've got at the moment are the complete works of Maya Angelou, who I'm dipping in and out of with great delight, and W.H. Auden. And also there's a really good anthology called Emergency Kit. I think it might, it's not a Seamus Heaney, I'm not quite sure who edited it, but it's got this back to the cat theme, it's got a poem by Peter Porter called The King of the Cats is Dead, and it's wonderful, and it's got a slight Auden-esque funeral blues feel about it, like a bit like Stop All the Clocks, The King of the Cats is Dead. I'm now completely mashing. That's a mashup, a poetry mashup, but you know what I mean. And waiting, kind of glaring at me from the wings, is The Fire and the Fury, which I have just bought, and I will read when my stomach feels strong enough, imminently.
And what next for you then, briefly? Because I noticed that at the end of the trilogy, you very definitely wrote the words, the end. So I'm guessing that is the end of the trilogy, or are you going to go back to those characters or do something completely different?
It's funny that they put that in there, because I write that on every manuscript, and it's just a format to let the editor know that there's no other pages they need to print out. But though Foxcroft is definitely finished, the complete story has now been told. Whether there would be a spin-off at some time, at some point, it's possible, and I wouldn't rule it out. I'm also developing another animal fantasy, and I'm writing something completely different as well. Annoyingly, I don't really talk about works in progress, mostly because I see them as sort of will-o'-the-wisps, these strange, intangible flighty things that, if held to the light, can somehow melt away from your grasp. So it's not because I'm being coy, it's because...
It's all right. You're not the first writer to say that. I absolutely understand. Well, we've been talking today about the Foxcraft Trilogy by Imbali Aselis, which is published by Scholastic. We'll come back to you, Imbali, in just a moment, so you can talk us through your last choice of music. But just a heads up, our next show, studio guest will be Rory McGrath. He'll be talking about the two volumes of his memoir. We'll also hear from Stefan Collini on essay writing and from the poet Michael Brown. It's been lovely chatting to you today, Imbali.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And you're going to, play us out, really, with your last choice of music, which is Muse, Map of the Problematique.
Well, this one. So, Foxcraft, what is Foxcraft? Foxcraft is fox magic, distinct types of magic like shape-shifting, like slimmering, which is a sort of invisibility. And the what the foxes say to each other, the elder foxes, is run fast, be safe, live free. And Isla the fox, the young cub, is going to have to learn to run fast and do all of these things and maybe just learn a little bit of fox magic. And this song seemed to fit that perfectly.